My name is Daniela Gibbs-Leger with the Center for American Progress, and I want to welcome you all to the Toxic Trains and a Terrorist Threat conference call. We are joined by Paul Orem, Reese Rushing, and PJ Crowley, who will all make brief opening comments, and then we will open it up for questions. You should all have the reports in your inboxes, but if for some reason you don't, it is on the front page of our website, which is www.americanprogress.org. With that, I'd like to turn the call over to Paul.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm Paul Orem, the author of this report and the person who conducted the survey that underlies it. And really the heart of this report is Appendix A, Appendix B, and the map on page 11. Appendix A is 37 remaining water utilities that still use chlorine gas in rail car sizes. Not lesser sizes, rail car sizes, very serious danger of a worst-case toxic gas release, whether accidental or caused by a terrorist. Appendix B shows that alternatives are available. It lists 25 water utilities that have switched off chlorine rail cars since 1999, either to chlorine bleach, liquid bleach, or in some cases, ultraviolet light. This basically eliminates the danger of a catastrophic rail release. The report also shows that conversion costs are quite manageable. That's page 10 and 12 and 13. Cost less than, a couple ways of looking at this, cost less than a bag of potato chips per person served on an annual basis, and often much less. Another way of looking at it is that converting all of the remaining U.S. water utilities that still use chlorine gas rail cars would be less than one day's expenditures in Iraq that we're spending in the military. The report also shows up systematic shortcomings in the new Department of Homeland Security interim chemical security regs that are released today. The water utilities are exempt. Rail transportation links are not considered in planning. And the options to eliminate unnecessary vulnerabilities are not really systematically considered. There are only very limited current regulations for security regulations for water utilities. Drinking water facilities have to do vulnerability assessments, but not any plan or action to fix vulnerabilities. And wastewater facilities have almost none. Just a couple other notes from the report. Page 6, the Association of American Railroads has testified before Congress that they want to eliminate unnecessary shipments of chlorine gas and other toxic inhalation hazard chemicals. And then on page 7 and 8, bleach manufacturers, the ones who make the replacement chemical, can also convert off chlorine gas rail cars. The only other general note is that liquid bleach, the most common replacement, is also chlorine. So when talking about what's being replaced, we usually refer to it specifically as chlorine gas. And again, it's just rail cars, not lesser sizes.
Thanks, Paul. This is Reese Rushing. Just to underscore a few of the things that Paul's just said, I really look at this as the low-hanging fruit for chemical security. We've identified 25 or 30 water utilities that still receive chlorine gas by rail. Other water utilities have converted from chlorine gas rail cars. We know that we can do this. It's affordable. We just need to move in that direction. Yet DHS's new chemical security regulations don't address this problem at all. We're continuing to ignore this vulnerability and transportation hazards in particular, and millions of people are in danger as a result. Congress and the administration must act immediately to address this vulnerability and protect our communities.
This is PJ Crowley. I direct the Homeland Security Program here at the Center, and I'm a retired military officer, so I come at this primarily from a security standpoint. And when you see the report on our website, on the cover, there is a picture of acutely hazardous rail car with the Capitol here in Washington in the background. I think that picture says a lot in terms of, even if you envisioned that a system could be safely managed, and that's that could be the case, even though you presume and understand from some of the recent accidents in Kentucky and elsewhere that there are always going to be accidents. But even if you envision that there would be a fairly decent safety record, there's a difference between safety and security. And when you have a situation where you have a rail track coming directly through a target city like Washington, D.C., this cannot be secured. So what you see in this picture, it cannot be secured. If you're putting acutely hazardous material within proximity of a landmark like the U.S. Capitol that was a target on 9/11, or if you're putting these chemicals on a rail track that goes through a major urban center with a high population density, then you are creating a terrorist opportunity. And as we see in Iraq in recent weeks, that al-Qaeda and the insurgency in Iraq have started to pick up and use chlorine as a weapon. And so this is not a kind of conceptual threat. It's something that we're seeing on the battlefield in Iraq and potentially could migrate to other places. One other comment, just to put this in the context of the interim final rule that DHS put forth today. Obviously, water treatment facilities is a major exemption that was specifically ruled out of the legislation that Congress passed last fall. So, what Paul has put together here, is kind of one of those major gaps in the system. One of the problems with the approach that DHS is taking is that they separate, chemical facilities on the one hand and transportation on the other. And you can envision a situation where you might have a chemical facility X, in one, fairly remote part of the United States with fencing, lighting, access controls, and so forth. And that could be where the chemical is manufactured. You could envision, chemical facility Y, a similar situation. But if the rail track that links the two goes right through a Washington, D.C. or some other major cities around the country, then you haven't really solved the problem. And I think part of it is that this is a limited rule based on a fairly limited piece of legislation that Congress passed last fall. And DHS is looking at the chemical facilities as one problem, looking at rail transportation as a separate problem. And until they really effectively put them together, we're not going to be as safe and secure as we can be. And on the issue of inherently safer technology, to pick up on what Reese and Paul said, where the rail industry is now becoming an advocate of inherently safer, its technology, but inherently safer processes as the long-term solution. Unfortunately, DHS today in its interim rule, takes a passive stance on IST. It says, well, it's one of the options that a facility could employ, but as Paul has documented here, on the one hand, you see progress that individual facilities are in fact making the switch to inherently safer processes. On the other hand, until you attack this in a systemic way and as a national challenge, which DHS has really yet to do, we're going to have pockets of security, but we're going to have major pockets also of insecurity. And so I just echo what the other two have said in terms of ultimately we have to take a broader and more systemic approach to make sure that we are solving this on a national basis, not just on a localized basis.
Thank you, PJ. I would like to open it up for questions now.
And we'll take our first question from Todd Smoot with KCBS Radio.
Good afternoon. Could you talk about the safety of the rail car? How difficult would a rail car be to breach? And talk a little bit about the area. What would happen after one was breached? What type of area would be contaminated for how long? That sort of thing.
AJ, do you want to talk about the breaching of rail cars?
I'll start off. In the DHS recently passed towards the end of 2006 interim rule on rail transportation, and their basic approach is just to make sure that rail cars are traveling faster. And they're trying to reduce the idle time, which is a reasonable interim approach, but it's really not a long-term solution. You know, there is some research being done on future generations of rail cars that could, you know, with more a case of terrorism in mind, as opposed to just the idea that you might be involved in a derailment, and many of these cars are relatively old, much like the oil tankers. They're single hulled, so they are. You know, obviously, as we've seen in a variety of accidents, when they're disturbed, they can break up. And when they break up, they can release, these deadly chemicals. So it is something that needs to be done. I suppose the most important thing that I look at, every morning here in Washington, I commute here by metro. And my metro platform is right next to a CSX rail line. And there's frequently a freight train on the tracks as I'm standing on the metro platform, and about every third car has graffiti on it. I mean, that's the most significant aspect. Is if an artist can get to a car, to draw on it, then a terrorist can get to a car to put some sort of explosive next to it. And even if you start to speed up the idle time here, still this is a system that is broadly vulnerable. And certainly with some sort of projectile, you could envision even if a train was traveling, was actually in motion. Still, under the majority of cars that are currently on the rails, they could easily be disrupted, and if they're disturbed, chances are something's going to get released.
To add a little bit more about the consequences, it would depend on the weather conditions, but in a day where you had dense, slowly moving air mass, the kind of day where fog might settle down in the hollows, or a very hot, humid day, the air hardly seems to move, then a worst-case release would send a greenish-yellow ground-hugging plume for many miles downwind. It would remain hazardous for up to 14 miles downwind in an urban area, and possibly as much as 25 or more miles in a rural area.
And just to illustrate PJ's point about the graffiti, if you look at page 15 of the report, we have a rail car photographed there that's covered in graffiti at just a few blocks from the National Mall.
Thank you.
Take our next question from Greg Hyatt with Inside Washington Publishers.
Thank you. I'm out here in California, in Sacramento, covering environmental policy. I'm just kind of wondering if there are things you guys think that state agencies here in California, for example, the California EPA, can be doing to address some of these issues in your report. Or other state agencies, for that matter.
Well, certainly there are a half dozen water utilities still in California, including the Sacramento Regional Wastewater Treatment Plant in Elk Grove, California, near Sacramento, that should be converting off of chlorine gas rail cars into safer alternatives. That is our basic argument as the best way to address this problem: eliminate the danger, eliminate the target, and do so at an affordable cost. Notably, at least some of the utilities in the Los Angeles areas are investing heavily in big containment and scrubber buildings and facilities around the rail car, which might serve their purpose right there when the chlorine gas is on site, but it certainly does nothing to protect that chlorine gas en route and through all the cities and towns along the way. So again, we would urge states to take action to convert the remaining facilities off chlorine gas rail cars, the remaining water utilities.
This is Reese. It should also be pointed out that states and local governments don't have control over the railways and the hazardous cargo that's being delivered, that really can only be addressed at the national level.
PJ Crowley, just to on the map that we have there, you see a mix of green and red dots and blue triangles, and part of the challenge here is that there are on isolated instances, both in terms of this report that Paul has done and the one he did last year, that show that on a community by community basis, certain. Certain communities have taken the initiative and are shifting to, say, from chlorine gas to one of a handful of alternatives. But if you're when you kind of look at this from a system-wide standpoint, you could have, say, the community of Wilmington, Delaware, for example, which is on the, the CSX I-95, northeast, freight corridor. They have done it. Philadelphia has done it. Others have taken the initiative on their own and have shifted to inherently safer alternatives. But there undoubtedly are still rail cars on those lines going through those communities, heading for somewhere else, because some community further down the track has not done it. And so this is where ultimately the solution is that DHS should not be neutral in this. If they are determined to see the United States lower the risk of a successful terrorism event involving hazardous chemicals, then they really need to offer both a strong regulatory framework, perhaps linked with some incentives to help encourage those that Paul has documented who are still have not converted, to kind of get beyond this inertia and so that we can chemical by chemical, process by process, we're never going to eliminate this risk, because obviously our society does rely to a significant extent on many of these chemicals. But if we can, sector by sector, chemical by chemical, at least, significantly lower its use, then we will lower the opportunities for terrorists to be successful sometime in the future.
We'll take our next question from Eric Nelson with the Bay Area News Group.
Hi. I just was wondering, what if your community is not on this list? Is there any assumption you can make on that they're not using rail cars?
You can about 99% assume that if they're not on the list, they're not using chlorine gas rail cars. Specifically, if they are, they're required to report that to EPA, and we use that information as the source of our information. There is that 1% chance that a facility has failed to report as required. However, I would be surprised by that.
Could they be using trucks?
Yes, they could be using trucks. They could be using smaller size containers, such as a one-ton cylinder of chlorine gas. Again, we focused on rail cars because almost exclusively these are 90-ton rail cars, 180,000 pounds. In a very few instances, they're 55-ton rail cars, 110,000 pounds. But that is far and away the largest danger, especially when compared to a one-ton cylinder. Now, we did not include in the report facilities that made a partial conversion down to one-ton cylinders, because ultimately that is not a full solution. We simply reported on those that had converted entirely off of chlorine gas to liquid bleach or ultraviolet light or other alternatives.
Okay, I mean, the rail industry will say that their rail tankers are a somewhat safer way to transport chemicals than a tractor trailer a container on, or a tanker or container on a tractor trailer. I just wonder what your feeling is about that.
A number of facilities are going to to generating bleach on site. That requires every few months, possibly, shipments of salt as opposed to more frequent shipments of chlorine. And, of course, then that alternative, generating the chlorine bleach on site or ultraviolet light, simply eliminate most of transportation hazards altogether. There's also simply something incomparably large about the 90-ton rail car, and again, we did not include in the report any facility that on a temporary interim basis might be going to trucks or one-ton cylinders. Those facilities, we believe, should thoroughly convert off of chlorine gas, as so many other utilities have.
Okay.
Also, it should be noted that the Association of American Railroads supports the development of
Who's speaking now?
I'm sorry, this is Reese Rushing.
Okay.
So the Association of American Railroads supports conversion to less hazardous chemicals.
Okay.
And so they recognize the threat, and they want it removed.
And I think, P.J. Crowley, just to pick up on this, I think you're right that but this is the difference between safety and security, and just simply shifting chlorine, say, from a rail car to a highway is not the answer either. That's one of the reasons why we strongly advocate that the only real way to significantly reduce the risk is to try to reduce the amount of chlorine that is used. And this happens to be one sector of the chemical industry where it is proven that there are far more safe and secure alternatives, and that they are economically viable, as Paul has documented. But it is part of there's part of the unique aspect of the freight rail system by design that they tend to go right through the heart of major population centers, even if you put some of this chlorine on trucks and they're on interstates, that is a hazard. But even the interstate might go around a major metropolitan area. But I think that it's to say that the rail system is it does represent a very significant threat. It is not only the movement through major population centers, but also it is the fact that once a rail car arrives at its destination, it sits on a rail siding. The rail siding may or may not have significant security associated with it. So, and that sits there as a target for a lengthy period of time. So there are a variety of ways of getting beyond this, as Paul mentioned. Moving to different manufacturing or storage options. That's a good step, but obviously, being able to shift from gas, which is poses a unique danger because of its ability to migrate off-site, to the extent that we can shift to liquid bleach or ultraviolet radiation, you really are going from what is risk management to risk elimination, and where we have that opportunity, we should take advantage of it.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next question from Russell Dinage with Greenwire.
Oh, yes, hi. I'm just curious to know a little bit more about how you calculated the cost of the conversion for the facilities. You say in your report it's $1.50 per day per person. Is that correct, or it's less than the cost of one day's operations in the war in Iraq? I'm just curious to know, I mean, is there a way that we can average that out so that we can get a fuller financial picture of what it would cost to actually for an average facility serving an average number of customers, that receives chlorine gas by rail right now to convert to safer alternatives?
First, just to be clear, it's not $1.50 per day. It is a single day's expenditures in Iraq, which I've seen variously as million to 275 million a day.
Uh-huh.
If you divide that out by the number of, for example, the costs of the 20 facilities that we cite specific information for in the report, on pages 12 and 13, you don't come anywhere near that figure. You come up to about a third of it. I don't know of a way to average it other than the way we did it, but if you look on pages 12 and 13, there is facility-specific information for 20 facilities. And this includes construction costs and a year's worth of changes in costs, such as paying a little more for chemicals, but then paying less for security, less for maintenance, and certain other factors.
So on this list of facilities on page 12, I don't know if you have the report in front of you. I'm sure you do. The one that's the largest would be which one?
The largest water utility?
Yeah, the largest. Yeah, the facility that serves the largest number of people on this list. I haven't had a chance to look at it yet.
In Appendix B, there is a column called approximate facility size in million gallons per day.
Yes.
And for the most part, those are average figures. In a few cases, they are facility capacity. I learned in doing the report that there's a number of ways one can describe such things, but certainly many large facilities already are free of chlorine gas entirely. According to a Government Accountability Office report, about two-thirds of wastewater plants serving 100,000 people or more public water systems already use or plan to use something other than chlorine gas. On the drinking, and that's in the report, on the drinking water side, it's not quite as high, but there are at least 160 drinking water facilities around the country that serve 100,000 people or more as a public water system that already use something other than chlorine gas.
Okay, so a facility that serves 100,000 people, then, I mean, what would it cost for that facility to convert to safer alternatives?
Well, I'm looking at the, you know, on page 12, the 100,000 people, Western Lake Superior Sanitary District, Duluth, Minnesota, just to pick one out.
Yes.
We calculated they have about 110,000 people. That we calculated their annual conversion cost at about $1 per person served. However, other facilities on this list, it can be much less, and it varies depending on quite a few factors, whether it's a wastewater or drinking water facility, the size of the facility, the size of the population served. Ultimately, what we decided was rather than try to come up with the perfect formula and the perfect cost average, was simply to go back to these facilities and ask them, do these figures seem correct in general terms for your facility and for all 20 of these facilities? Where we list specific costs, we can say that they responded and confirmed that they are in the ballpark.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Our next question comes from Scott Streeter with the Fort Worth Star.
Yes. Hey, I. it looks like from Appendix A that facilities in the DFW area, there's more than anywhere in the country that have these shipments of chlorine gas via rail car. There's at least, looks like half of them are considering alternatives, at least considering them. How positive, from a good news standpoint, you know, is that they're at least considering, you know, not using chlorine as the primary source of disinfectant for drinking wastewater treatment?
Well, it was actually quite positive in conducting the survey to speak with facilities. One in particular in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, the Rolling Hills Water Plant,
right.
In which when I first contacted them in the fall, they did not have plans to convert. When I went back for some additional information a couple months later, they were, in fact, investigating alternatives. And certainly we would be very pleased to learn that other facilities are interested in converting on an accelerated time schedule. I will point also to the conversion status column in Appendix A. It does include details of some facilities that want to switch over, but others that simply told us they had no plans to convert.
Right. the six in our area at least are, four of the six that do. So looks like at least they're thinking about it, even if not doing it.
Yes.
P.J. Crowley, I think, you know, part of the challenge is just, you know, to have these facility operators, and to the extent they might be, you know, operated by, you know, municipalities, to have, you know, mayors or city managers, you know, think of that terrorism frame of how, you know, to evaluate this. You know, I mean, obviously, if you're a politician today and you are thinking about a bond issue or something to do some, you know, some facility upgrades, you know, anything that costs money, there's obviously, you know, some bureaucratic inertia or some public resistance to this. You know, but as Paul and Reese mentioned, you know, there may well be some upfront costs involved here. On the other hand, on the backside, there is, you know, definitely some cost avoidance in terms of the volume of equipment, the training that, you know, your fire and EMS have to go through because that chemical exists in the region. I'm sure there's some insurance costs. So, you know, if you look at this over the broad frame, you know, clearly, you know, this is something that is going to more than pay for itself over time. But I think the other aspect is that in a variety of dimensions, obviously, you know, if we fly today, you know, there's a $5 fee in terms of a security fee on the plane ticket. I think if you probably asked most of the voters in various communities around the country, you know, would you pay, you know, $1.50 a year in order to basically get your community off the terrorism target list? Most people would say, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's where, you know, as much as anything, we just have to, you know, start to look at things, you know, in our society, you know, look at them within the framework of what could a terrorist do. I mean, heck, you know, because of Oklahoma City, for example, we now, you know, monitor, you know, major sales of fertilizer around the country because we now recognize, you know, that there's a danger based on what was done in Oklahoma City back in 1995. And this is another area where you just, you know, because of where we are, we just have to take a broader look at this through the terrorism framework. And obviously, as Paul has documented, many, many communities around the country have done that same thing and decided, you know, we can switch this. Over time, the cost is amortized out over a number of years and more than pays for itself.
Okay, great. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. If you have any further questions, feel free to contact me. My phone number is 202-741-6258. Thank you.